welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show, a student-hosted chat show focusing on topics in philosophy, sociology, psychology, and other areas of the humanities. We hope you enjoy the following program. I've got a little quote here to start us off. My quote's very small. It's a really quick one, and I've got a quandary as well. But the quote is, fact is stranger than fiction. So my quote is, fact is stranger than fiction. And I think that it was just a quote that, to be honest, I'm going to tell you listeners, I actually didn't write where the quote came from. So you're going to have to look that up yourself. Or maybe I made it up.
I was going to say, like, this is quite a, not to diminish you bringing this quote to the table, but in a certain way, this is almost like a stock kind of phrase at this point, right? When something strange happens, people will say, like, you can't make this up, you know, or fact is stranger than fiction. So in a way, I am sort of curious, like, where or what prompted you to bring this up, but obviously you're going to have something to say about it.
Yeah, exactly. It is a little bit of a stock phrase. You can kind of imagine it on those sort of, like, you know, backgrounds of, like, you look up quotes on the internet and it's got some background of, like, a pebbles or the mountains, and it says fact is stranger than fiction. But the reason I want to say that is because where the quote kind of came from, where I was reading it, when I was thinking about it, was basically this. Fiction is a narrative structure. Things need to make sense in some kind of way. All the components of a fictional story need to be cohesive. Even if that story is kind of surrealist or strange or out there or difficult to understand, it has to be coherent. Whereas fact, i.e. like, you know, day-to-day life, the individual human beings, like, we don't have the capacity to understand every aspect of what's going on. So, for example, when I read a book by, let's say I read The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck, I'm reading an encapsulated whole story. I'm getting the whole pie of this world effectively, right? Of what the author wants to convey to me, you know, if I'm smart enough and literate enough to understand it. But it's there. Whereas, you know, the factual life, real life, is full of mysteries and question marks and things we don't understand and, you know, causations that we'll never realize or consequences that we'll never know. And that's just more a reflection of our limited ability to understand the world around us. When we say stranger than fiction, it's more, in some sense, you could look at it as stranger in terms of, like, a stranger, right? There's so much out there in the world, that in the real world, quote unquote, that is just always going to be strange to us, be foreign to us, and we can never get the complete pie. We can never get the complete whole.
I think your framing of fiction as necessarily being narrative is a really good way to sort of delimit, put clamps down on fiction, as it were, and really give the stock phrase a little bit more meaning. You know, it makes me realize that any fictional narrative that I've read, it's almost kind of like you can think of it as like being on a tape reel. Right. Or, I mean, usually it's on books, it's on pages of a book, right? And you can leaf through them. The time that it takes to go, or the sort of narratological time that exists in it, can be jumped around in, right? You have every opportunity to sort of go through a story's time and give every enunciation or every passage or every scene its due as far as, like, constructing the meaning for it. Whereas in reality, time just, you know, goes 1 second per second, right? It's just going to keep unfolding, and there's no, like, there's time to like investigate your memories or like things that happened and whatnot, but it's still going to keep going. It's not a book that has a definite end. And I mean, if it does have a definite end, that's not, you know, that's not going to be in time that you can investigate in. Right.
Yeah. You know, and we've talked about specifically I'm thinking about like Byung-Chul Han and like narrative structures and stuff like that, and how, like, you know, we're narrative creatures. And in some sense, I think we could see fiction as an exercise in the narrative process that we also use in real life, right? Like, we live by stories, we make up stories about ourselves, the world we live in, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, ultimately, the stories that we have are the stories that we live by are always going to be far more porous, right? There's always going to be little holes and things that, you know, are, you know, kind of contradict each other or mysteries or whatever it might be, right? So that was really the point of that little quote. Do you have a quote or quandary?
I'd have a little quote as well. So I picked up another Wittgenstein text. This one is Culture and Value, which is an assemblage of various passages on various themes. It's quite a hodgepodge, actually. It's thematically, it has a couple strands. Wittgenstein talks a lot about music. He explains himself a little bit as far as his project and what he's doing. But there's just also little tidbits here, right? Wittgenstein is very aphoristic. It's quite ripe for quoting from. And I wanted to read a short one, just comment on it. So the quote is, "A curious analogy could be based on the fact that even the hugest telescope has to have an eyepiece no larger than the human eye." So what I want to comment on with this quote is that Wittgenstein here is constructing an analogy, right? He says that there's something that an analogy could be like, right? The fact that a telescope, so if you have an enormous telescope, one that points into space, or even one that you just used for casual stargazing, all of them have to have, as an input for your vision, lenses that are suited for your own eye, right? Now, what I really like about this quote is that it's only half of a metaphor, right? Like, all metaphors have two parts, because when you are saying something is metaphorical, you are saying that something is something else. So metaphor is necessarily complex. What Wittgenstein is doing here is his metaphor is complex, but it only has one part. It's kind of like a car without an engine. You know, the hood is up and the engine's not there. It's an incomplete metaphor. But what's really interesting is it still has that sort of insightful wit that a metaphor has, right? What he's saying is that even though this sort of part B of the metaphor is only there and it's not to be contrasted to a part A, he still has the insight to see something about a telescope that could be analogized to something else, right? And it's that kind of insight into the structure of a single part itself that I think makes Wittgenstein a particularly keen, I don't want to say analyst, because that's someone who is breaking, you know, things up into their parts. What Wittgenstein is doing here is just seeing the structure of a whole, right? And he's seeing it unanalogized, or that it could be analogized in a certain way, right? This is more or less just me like gushing about Wittgenstein, saying that, yeah, he's very insightful in this way of being able to capture a whole and understanding it as like an object of comparison, right? He's not even using it in a comparison, but he just knows that there's something deep here in this particular thing, the telescope.
Yeah, and I think it's a really interesting, because it's also like, you know, as you necessarily said, there's always multiple components of a metaphor or analogy. And, you know, like when you think about something like a telescope, obviously you think it looking up at the stars, you look up at the universe, all that kind of stuff. And yet, as he kind of says, like, you know, ultimately, though, the lens has to fit the human eye, right? So you're sort of getting this picture of this conduit of something that like gazes towards the heavens, is, you know, looking towards the infinity of the universe or whatever it might be, and yet still needs to be translated into our limited or specific kind of human understanding.
Yeah, like I can think of analogous cases to this, even like, say, for example, like infrared vision or ultraviolet vision, it has to be rendered in our spectrum, right? Or
yeah, exactly, that's a great example.
Or like supersonic or sub-bass sound recordings or something, right? You know, what other animals can hear, it has to be rendered within our audio spectrum.
I've got a little quandary here as well, a real quick one, which I think actually leads interestingly into our formal discussion for today. So the quandary I wanted to bring up was the distinction really between views of sex, particularly in the medieval world, and views of sex and sexuality in the modern world. First off, I think obviously when people think about sex and sexuality in the medieval world, they think of it being very repressed and very, you know, kind of is, you know, seen as very sinful, seen as very problematic, all this kind of stuff. But the reason I bring it up is it's a great example of these kind of cultural shifts that we've gone on from kind of like maybe a more organic, local, comfortable world in some ways to a much more bureaucratic and global system. And what I'll say about that is basically, first of all, medieval people were much less prudish than we think. Like, that's not what the evidence says at all, right? Like, medieval people were obviously, you know, getting down, as they say, in various kinds of ways and doing their thing. And it was people in the medieval world were actually more comfortable than probably most of us with sexuality being around them, i.e. in the home, in the town, in the field. Like, you have to think, right, like, people didn't have the same kind of like privacy that they do today, right? So people, you know, had sexual relations in one room homes, like with other people around, or, you know, in like, you know, at the back of a local like tavern, or, you know, in the corner of a square or whatever it might be. And these things were seen as like very normal, right? Like, there were a lot of laws and rules and edicts, but the actual act of sexuality and sex was not really something that people cared that much about in the same sort of way. Whereas now, obviously, it's great that we have, you know, this sort of like sense of legal sexual freedom. We keep the government and state out of the bedroom. But there's also this cultural dynamic of like being, you know, more shamed. It needs to be more private. It's like this kind of like, ew, gross, don't talk about it. You know, whereas like people just like didn't care as much back then. And I think like there is some mirroring going on in terms of what we'll talk about in terms of friendship, where like changes in, you know, material changes, cultural changes, and changes in media really have shifted our opinion and the way we do a lot of different stuff, whether it's sex or friendship or whatever.
Yeah. This is something that I've kind of like, it's a topic that I don't know necessarily how to approach, not because it's like so taboo or anything like that. Like, you know, the books are out there. You can just go and read them. But at the same time too, I like, even as far as the information being accessible, it still sort of confronts me how something like that shift happens, right? Like, I'm vaguely aware of like a history of sexuality where something like the mindset that you're kind of describing, where while it's certainly not like something you just do, it doesn't have the same sort of like taboo connotations that it did. And then at some point, and this is usually associated with like the Victorian era, and I don't, again, like I guess part of the quandary for me is like, I wish I knew what it was about the Victorian zeitgeist that sort of causes this stigma or this taboo to emerge. Obviously it has something to do with like material conditions or economic conditions, considering that the Victorian era is the sort of child of the Industrial Revolution in England and whatnot. Yeah. So it just is, as far as like, and the curious thing is like, how does like the material conditions of the Industrial Revolution lead to social change that is so drastic like that?
Yeah, drastic in every era. And it's also important to remember, like, okay, you're talking about the Victorian era, which I think you're hitting the nail right on the head. That's an important era to look at. But it's also really important to remember that the era prior to the Victorian era is generally called the Baroque period, which was like the most flagrant and open. And you know what I mean? Like, that was the era where it was really like all out there and people didn't really care and they rolled their eyes at the church a lot of the time, right? Like, you know, there's many, 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 many famous paintings from the Baroque era where the sexual themes are like very obvious, extremely blatant, right? So there's, you know, within the obviously there was still different taboos and all sorts of discrimination and stuff like that. But there was also this just more day-to-day comfortability that has seemed to change, with this kind of lack of shame around sexuality that has kind of come more from the Victorian era. And I think we'll get into that. And I think it's worthwhile to probably jump in the discussion for today, because I think our questions for both will kind of be revealed to the same sort of discussion.
Yes. I was just going to introduce the material that we sort of went over. Yeah. Yeah. So you sent me an interesting video sort of as a means to stimulating further discussion on, our thoughts on friendship, because we've covered kind of in a previous episode, we kind of covered the theoretical basis, at least with Aristotle. And just like as a very quick recap, obviously not going to go into as much detail as the last episode, but for the framework more or less is that Aristotle has this idea of three kinds of friendship, analyzing his Greek term philia, right? There's friends of utility, friends of pleasure, and friends of character. The friends of utility, all these friendships seek some kind of good. The friends of utility seek what is useful from each other, so their good is the aim of advantage. Then the friends of pleasure want what is pleasant from each other, so they're looking for pleasant experiences in that particular relationship. But Aristotle thinks that these two kinds of friendship are not true kinds of friendship. The true friendship is friendships of character, where you're actually friends with the person, right? Whereas in the previous two, they're more or less means to an end, right? And by virtue of that, those two kinds of friendships are less permanent, because as soon as what one seeks in those relationships, once one gets those, the relationship is over. Whereas when you're in a friendship of character, since the object of that sort of friendship is the person themselves, it's much more durable. And the more virtuous that a person is, the more stable that relationship is liable to be, right? So that's very roughly the ground that we covered. Now, the material that we watched, so there was a short sort of video essay by the channel Folks of Yore that was put out quite recently, and it's discussing the changes in conceptions of friendship over time, very broadly speaking, covering three particular, sort of like highlighting three particular thinkers who exemplified the value of friendship. So that was Aristotle, not surprisingly, but then also Cicero and Montaigne, who also wrote treatises on friendship and the value of it, and going over sort of the changes in specifically like the world prior to ours in terms of friendship, the ancient world and the early modern world, where friendship was not just something that was valued, but it was considered among one of the necessities of a good life, right? Like if you didn't have close friends, or if you didn't have these character or friends of virtue, someone who you could share in almost, close, dare to use again, broaching on this strange taboo that we seem to have, almost like an intimate relationship, you weren't considered to be living a life that was fully potential, like fully actualized, one whose potentialities were really seen to blossom, right? If you didn't engage in a relationship that was one based on trust, that was one based on uplifting one's character and really addressing the other as one truly was, right? So,
you've hit the nail on the head in terms of what this picture looked like. And I think, it's like worth kind of trying to picture the social world that, what, really Aristotle, Cicero, Montaigne, it's important to remember that 2000 years separate all these people, but the largely because of, I would argue, technology, the technological, situation that people lived in, and how it was relatively similar, whether you're living, in 400 BC Greece, 180 Rome, or 1500, France, that, you're living in this very social, personal, face-to-face world, right? Here's another important thing. If you're dealing with media of some kind, it's usually long form and complex. I think about, like, the most obvious example is, you know, especially for, say, Montaigne, would be something like reading the Bible, right? Or, you know, if it's Cicero, it's, you know, going to the forum and listening to, you know, multi-hour long speeches and debates. Or if it's Aristotle, it's sitting around, you know, at the academy and having long form discussions and all this kind of stuff. And as well, a lot of these people lived, generally speaking, in smaller worlds. And I know, like, obviously the world physically size hasn't changed, but, like, you know, Cicero might be a little bit of an exception because he lived in Rome, which was, like, you know, a city of over 1 million people at one point. But, and I think when he lived there, but, you know, Montaigne lived in a state outside of a small town. Aristotle lived in Athens, which frankly wasn't that big, right? Like, you know, it was like, you know, probably 50 to 60,000 people. Right. And so you're seeing a lot of the same people, you're interacting with a lot of the same people in your day to day life, and you get to know specific people really, really well. And you spend your, if you're going to have any kind of communication with them, it's almost certainly, it's either going to be really of two forms. You're going to be talking to them or you're going to be writing them letters. Like, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, and writing letters is another case that sort of came up in the video as well. He uses the example of Ralph Waldo Emerson and Thomas Carlyle, how they had a meeting in, I think it was Scotland, and based on just that single meeting, they began a correspondence that lasted, I think, 37 years, just exchanging letters, mostly discussing philosophy and anything that was just of interest to them. But the point is that there was a sort of mediating factor there that nonetheless was born out of, like, a real world experience. They encountered one another, and just based on that, they were able to spark a friendship that lasted a very long time.
Yeah, I think this is, like, a really key friendship to talk about. I forget Montaigne's best friend's name, and I know it's, like, some French name that I've in the past have a hard time pronouncing, so I'm not going to bother. But the important point is that these letters that they wrote to each other were, by, like, our standards, I think a lot of people would consider them, like, very close. And I think if most people read them, they, like, through today's eyes, they would have the perception that they were in, you know, that they were kind of romantic, right? Like, there's now, I think this is the key, you know, that folks of yours kind of pointing out, is that, like, you know, super close friendships like that have an almost romantic quality to them, right? Like, you know, and then this is sort of what Aristotle talks about too, in terms of, like, you really do love and appreciate the person for who they are, and that is fully reciprocated in those noble relationships.
All of these sort of exemplify what Aristotle initially lays out as friendships of character, right? I mean, in the example of Ralph Waldo Emerson and Thomas Carlyle, what they're doing is stimulating each other in philosophical, intellectual engagements, right? They are continuing to push each other as far as their intellectual developments go, and they're exploring ideas and whatnot, maybe, you know, engaging in a more mundane talk. But more or less, what they're doing is taking each other's relationship with each other seriously.
It's serious in the sense of this genuine, you know, fealty, this genuine care and love. You know, we talked about the Victorian era earlier, and the Victorian era is kind of interesting as also, you know, that's the same kind of period as the Romantic era and the beginnings of the era of, like, authenticity and stuff like that, where personal identity becomes really, really important. And there's a couple components of that that I think are really important that have impacts on friendship. One of them is, now if personal identity is so, like, key, right? Like, your authentic self, who you are, and who you are has all these sort of, like, you know, prefixes or suffixes added to them, you know, well, then certain acts will make you, will give you a certain kind of identity. So, for example, if you come across as super romantic with your friends, well, now you might be labeled homosexual, right? Like, individual actions are starting to be really like collected and condensed into categories of identity that, you know, get pushed, you know, put onto people, whether it's how they see themselves or how the wider community sees them as well.
Right. Yeah. I think you're referencing, there's a part in this video as well where they talk about the conceptualization of the idea of the identity of the homosexual, right? It's not just that there is such a thing as homosexuality. There emerges this idea of the identity of the homosexual. And he specifically references Michel Foucault's A History of Sexuality and the transition from the idea of the sodomite to the homosexual, right? So this is the idea that prior to the identification of the homosexual, there's just the act of what was called sodomy, right? Of what we call gay sex. This was just an act. It was something that you did, and it didn't, it would reflect on, you know, your soul insofar as it was a sin, but it was not something that constituted your being, right? And this is largely in part because what we could call like the social infrastructure for an identity didn't really exist, because they lived in, not in the age of authenticity, but in a completely different age where you were your social role, right? You weren't really a particular kind of person who had a truth about them. You existed in a social order, and your identity, quote unquote, was a part of that. Now, with the Victorian era and the emergence of the Industrial Revolution, when people are moving out of feudal role-based systems and trying to live in cities and being removed from their traditional roles, there becomes the question of who you are. And so there is almost this like chicken and egg kind of game that happens, where it's like, well, you have to have identities to identify, like to be an identity of, in order for there to be this whole like identity language game, as it were. But at the same time, the material conditions just are the removal from the age of, I'm forgetting what it is called. Do you remember
the video from Folks of Yore?
No, I'm referencing George Hahn Mueller's You and Your Profile. There's the prior age to authenticity.
Yeah, I know this too. It's the age of, was it the age, not the age of sincerity.
Oh, sincere. It was in the age of sincerity.
So
in the age of sincerity, you sincerely enact your role. Now that the social conditions are changing, you have to identify as a particular thing, because you are, as an individual, lifted from that feudal system where your role was just given to you and all you had to do was sincerely perform that role. Now, one of the sort of consequences of this is the construction of all kinds of identity formations, right? And one of the kind of intersections that this happens with is the medicalization of sexuality, because prior to this, it was seen as something kind of sinful. Just any kind of persistence of this was as a deformity. So there was the attempt to categorize these and make a typology of the deformities of sexuality, which unfortunately...
Yeah, and I think deformity... is a really good way of putting it, because it's like when you live in the age of sincerity, you have these roles. You know, you're a knight, you're a clergyman, you're a peasant or whatever it might be, right? You're a king. And, you know, within the context, you obviously can transgress,